Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear from Lawrence Lessig about the many ways big money corrupts Congress. You and I don't need to be told about the general problem, but some of the specific examples Lessig gives are fascinating. I hope you'll stay tuned. Lawrence Lessig is an activist liberal law professor, now teaching at Harvard. To me, none of that counts as really high praise, but to be fair, Lessig has done a lot of good for American public life. He's been very active in promoting intellectual freedom, internet freedom, copyright reform, election reform, and other good causes. Lessig and I agree on this. Our Congress is bought and paid for. It spends all its time shafting the public and serving its fat cat contributors. What to do? Lessig talks about the need to take a radical approach. But it seems to me that Lessig is not a radical. For better or worse, he's a liberal reformer. At heart, he continues to believe that the situation can be reformed from within, though not easily. Who knows? Possibly he's right. And even he admits it's a long shot. In 2011, he published a book titled Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress, and a Plan to Stop It. The plan involves public financing of political campaigns and limits on the size of campaign contributions. Now, neither Congress nor the Supreme Court will let that happen. So he says the states need to call a constitutional convention and amend the Constitution to establish these reforms. Then just get at least 38 states to ratify this proposed constitutional amendment, and bingo. This is, shall we say, a long, long, long shot, for about 25 different reasons. At least six of them have probably occurred to you in the past 10 seconds. But I think Lessig is more persuasive when he discusses just how corrupt our Congress actually is. Let's hear part of a talk based on his book. Speaking in Seattle in October 2011, here is Lawrence Lessig.
So I have some examples to walk you through. The first recounts a fight that I had for many years in my life, as described by Eric, around the issues of copyright. I became a copyright activist on October 27, 1998, when President Clinton signed into law a statute honoring this great American, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Now, this was a statute that extended the terms of existing copyrights by 20 years. And the question Congress was supposed to ask when it passed that statute was, did such an extension advance the public good? Because, of course, extending the term of future copyrights, in theory, might create more incentives to produce great new works, in theory. But the thing we know about incentives is that they're prospective only, not in the world of Star Trek, but in our world, incentives are prospective only. Not even the United States Congress can get George Gershwin to do anything more. So when this statute was passed and we challenged it in the Supreme Court and we got some economists to join with us in a brief to say that this could not possibly advance the public good, this left-wing economist, oh, I'm sorry, wait, this is Milton Friedman, right-wing, Nobel Prize-winning economist, agreed to sign the brief only if the word no-brainer was in the brief somewhere. So obvious was it that it could not advance the public good to extend the term of existing copyrights. Yet apparently there were no brains here when Congress unanimously extended the term of existing copyrights. What there was more than $6 million in campaign contributions from Disney-related corporations to drive to a conclusion that would benefit them at the expense of a public good. Here's another example. Wall Street Journal was puzzled last January in an article they wrote about the extent of the temporary tax code. Temporary tax code means the provisions in the tax code which are set to expire. And as they expire, they get extended. And as they get extended, there is what the journal called extender mania. Meaning, as this provision's about to disappear, there's a frantic drive to get it extended once again. And the question the journal asked, and it's an interesting question given the rise of these temporary provisions, is what explains this explosion in extender mania. Now, the first of these temporary tax provisions was actually an idea of Reagan, or Reagan's staffers. In 1981, Congress passed the Research and Development Tax Credit. But it was controversial, and it was therefore made temporary in a bargain with the Democrats to ask the question after a number of years whether it worked. And the idea was, if the economist said it didn't work, they'd repeal it. But if the economist said it did work, they would make it permanent. And the answer was, after a couple of years, Democrat and Republican economists both says it did work. All of them agreed. It was a really great tax credit idea because it spurred the kind of investment that otherwise wouldn't have been invested in and therefore made sense absolutely to be part of our tax code. The puzzle is, it's still temporary. To this day, it is still temporary. So why is that? Well, Rebecca Kaisar, in this article in the Georgia Law Review, gives us a clue. She says the principal recipients of the research credit are large U.S. manufacturing corporations. These business entities are more than willing to invest in lobbying activities and campaign donations to ensure the continuance of this large tax savings. The Institute for Policy Innovation puts the point a little bit more crassly. This cycle has been repeated for years. Congress allows the credit to lapse until another short extension is given, preceded, of course, by a series of fundraisers and speeches about the importance of nurturing innovation. Congress essentially uses this cycle to raise money for re-election, promising industry more predictability the next time around. Now, this dynamic is critical, and it's central to how Washington works. But just think about it a bit. We are architecting tax policy not just to raise money for the federal government, but also to raise money for congressional campaigns that use the tax policy to essentially extort people into contributing to their campaigns, to make it easier to raise money, and not just tax policy. When Al Gore was vice president, his staff had an idea to change the way internet was regulated so that the disparate regulations of cable and telephone would be put under a new Title VII, and it would be essentially deregulated, fundamentally deregulated from the way it was when he first became vice president. Staff took the idea to Capitol Hill. The answer from Capitol Hill was, hell no. If we deregulate these guys, how are we going to raise money from them? So you begin to think we tax in order to raise campaign contributions. We architect regulation in order to raise campaign contributions. Campaign contributions have a lot to do with the architecture and reach, conservatives should recognize, of our government today. Or here's a third example. This is a picture of a 15-year-old boy. It's a picture of an epidemic in childhood obesity. Since 1980, we've tripled the number of kids who are obese. Now, for kids over the age of 2, 1/3 are technically obese. Now, this epidemic, of course, has costs. The most profound kind of cost is the rise of type 2 diabetes, the sort of diabetes that used to afflict just older people. Now, in some communities, 1/2 of the new cases come from kids. Total cost, as estimated by the Center for American Progress, is $147 billion annually in direct care costs. So why is this? What explains this change? Well, in part at least, it has something to do with what we eat. There's a consensus among people who know something about the matter that we eat too much of this stuff, not enough of this stuff. Or actually, not technically sugar. It's that we eat too much of this stuff, high fructose corn syrup. A mixture which in 1980 no human had ever consumed. Now 40% of the products in your supermarket have high fructose corn syrup in them. What explains that rise? Well, in part, it's because of the relative costs between sugar and corn. Sugar is expensive, corn is relatively cheap. And that leads lovers of the market to say, well, that's what the market demands, that's what the market demands. But it's not quite so simple here. Sugar is expensive in America because tariffs protect the domestic sugar industry, giving them at least $1 billion in extra profits every year and costing the economy about $3 billion in inefficiency costs because sugar costs in the United States 2 to 3 times what it costs anywhere else in the world. And corn is so cheap because it's subsidized, something like $74 billion in the last 15 years, leading some economists to say the cost of growing corn is actually negative. So when you add these two factors together, you can begin to understand the radical shift in the cost of foods So between 1997 and 2003, the cost of vegetables went up by 17%. Cost of a Big Mac went down by 5.4%. Cost of a bottle of Coke went down by 35%. And you can understand a radical shift in how food gets made. So I'm sure many of you saw this fantastic film, Food, Inc., which tells the story of how, because corn is so cheap, we can afford to feed our cattle corn rather than having them graze on grass. That's great for the factory farms that produce cattle in this way. Not so great for the cattle, because it turns out, of course, that the stomachs of cows don't actually digest corn well. It kind of stews in there. And as it stews in there, bacteria grows, which, of course, requires tons of antibiotics to deal with the sickness that's induced by this poor food for the cattle. And, of course, as you put tons of antibiotics in this mix, you begin to breed plentiful amounts of bugs that are resistant to the antibiotics. And if this were a film, we'd cut to a scene of a 4-year-old boy eating a hamburger and dying from the poison carried in that food. All of this because corn is so cheap, sugar is so dear. So the free marketer should say, what explains this anti-free market silliness? And there are lots of possible explanations. Presidential campaigns begin in Iowa, but it's, of course, obvious that there's endless campaign cash driving to both of these crazy conclusions. ADM has spent literally millions of dollars forcing through the subsidy of corn, not just for high fructose corn syrup purposes, but also to support the ethanol industry, and that sugar manufacturers have spent millions to continue to get the protection of tariffs to protect their domestic industry. If we can say it's because of this money, then we can say campaign money is distorting the market, which is distorting food production, which is distorting our kids' health. Or one more example, think about Wall Street. We just saw a collapse on Wall Street that triggered an extraordinary economic collapse in our society. What explains the collapse on Wall Street? Well, according to Simon Johnson and James Quack, it's something of a perverse mix, a mix of both too little government and too much government. Too little government in the form of deregulation. In the 1990s, there's an explosion of financial innovations, aka derivatives. But these innovations were invisible to the market, because also in the 1990s, there was an innovation in how we regulated financial assets. The government explicitly decided to exempt derivatives from the traditional regulations that applied to financial assets since the New Deal, regulations requiring that they be traded in a public exchange, transparently subject to anti-fraud requirements. So as my colleague Frank Partner calculated, in 1980, 98% of financial assets were traded subject to those traditional New Deal exchange rules. But by 2008, 90% of the assets traded in our market were traded exempted from those traditional New Deal rules, producing the shadow banking market, which of course encouraged this bubble. But that alone was not enough, according to Quack and Johnson. In addition, we have too much government. Because through the 1990s, there was a clear beacon given by the government to everybody within the industry that there would be, in effect, a government guarantee when this bubble burst. There would be a bailout on the other side, producing what is the dumbest form of socialism ever invented by man, socialized risk and privatized benefit. We pay the downside, they get the upside. Now, this is a technical legal term. A couple of lawyers, I'm sure, in the room will understand this. I apologize. But this is an insanely stupid way to regulate the financial system. But that's not the worst of it. All of that was before 2008. Even more astonishing is what happens after 2008. Where we add insult to injury in a way that is the life of Congress now. Because after 2008, after we had seen the worst crisis since the Depression, after it was obvious to all who are not in the pay of Wall Street that one of the causes of this collapse was the mismanagement in this regulation. People on the left and right, Judge Richard Posner wrote 2 books pointing to the mismanagement of financial regulation here. After the dean of deregulation, Alan Greenspan, confessed in testimony to Congress that he had been, quote, mistaken about how the financial services sector would behave, believing them to behave like good people as opposed to people who are just trying to make as much money as they can. After all of these things happened, still, Congress was blackmailed by the financial services sector on Wall Street into giving Wall Street a get-out-of-jail-free card and in passing a, quote, financial reform bill that left the core structural problem, the too-big-to-fail problem, in place and now even worse. If it was too big to fail before, it is only too big and to fail even more today. We are, as many argue, Johnson and Quack in particular, more at risk today of a collapse from precisely this failed architecture of regulation than we were in 2002. Now, why is it that we produce this craziness in how we regulate the system? I mean, the mistake before 2008 you might forgive by saying that zeitgeist was deregulation, but after 2008, what could explain the failure to re-regulate in a way that corrected that mistake? Well, lots of possible reasons. But the one thing we know is before 2008, the fastest growing and largest contributions came from financial sector and security sector. And in the 2010 election, the largest campaign contributions came from the financial sector and insurance sector. These two facts must be relevant to how we think about the insanity of this regulation. And one final example. I'm sure many of you, when you saw this video, thought to yourself, how is it possible that there could be such a large experimental drilling project without extensive impact, environmental impact and risk studies done? I mean, after all, in the area where I come from, we've just spent 9 years and 10,000 pages of environmental impact analysis to allow us to build this clean energy in the Bay. So when companies were trying to build these structures, in particular BP building the Deepwater Horizon, how much review were they forced to do before they were allowed to launch their project? And the answer is 17 pages before they were exempted from any further environmental impact analysis. And when Congress heard this, Congress was, of course, shocked.
I'm shocked to find that Gary is not here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Yet, of course, it was Congress that had required these fast-track approval projects, and exactly why Congress would require fast-track approval with experimental drilling technology, we don't know. Lots of possible reasons, but the one thing we do know is the endless stream of campaign cash supporting this decision. Now, no respectable liberal or libertarian or conservative could defend these cases. Each of them is an abomination from each of these philosophies. So how is it they come about? Now, the political scientist is uncertain. Political science is complex here. But here's the thing. You believe you know how they come about. All I have to do is point at the money, and you believe you have found a root cause. And my claim is, number one, it is because of cases like these that Americans believe that money buys results in Congress. Overwhelmingly, 75% of Americans believe money buys results in Congress, according to a poll we conducted at the beginning of the year. A little bit more Democrats than Republicans, but I guarantee you before the Republicans took control, it was the same, just reversed. So whether it's two-thirds or three-fourths, here's the thing we really agree upon. Money buys results in Congress. And that leads to number two. The fact that we believe this erodes our trust in this institution of Congress. Gallup found last year that 11% of Americans had confidence in Congress. Things have gotten better. Now it's 12%, according to the latest poll. 12% have confidence in Congress. We should put that in some context. When the Americans fought the revolution against the British crown, it's certainly the case that there were more who had confidence in the British crown than who have confidence in our Congress today. And that leads us to ask, at what point does a political institution need to declare a political bankruptcy? At what point do we say it has just lost the confidence of the people, requiring a fundamental change? But that leads to number three. This low trust erodes participation in the system. So Rock the Vote, the organization that turned out the largest number of young voters in the 2008 election, largest in the history of elections in the United States, and arguably responsible for producing the victory of Barack Obama, found that in 2010, many of their constituents were not going to vote, so they pulled them. And the number one issue, number one reason given by the members of the Rock the Vote organization was, no matter who wins, corporate interests will still have too much power and prevent real change. And that's not just a view of kids. The vast majority did not vote in this last election, in part at least because of this belief. Okay, now, of course, it wasn't supposed to be like this. The framers of our Constitution gave us what they called a republic, but as they meant that term, a republic was to be a, quote, representative democracy. And as Federalist 52 describes, a representative democracy was to include a branch of government that was, quote, dependent upon the people alone. So here's their model of government. We have the people, and we have the government. I do my own slides. That's really cool, right? The way that bounces. So this marionette relationship, the government's dependent upon the people. The problem is that Congress has evolved a different dependence. Not just a dependence upon the people, but increasingly a dependence upon the funders of campaigns. Because as members of Congress spend between 30 and 70% of their time raising money to get back to Congress or to get their party back into power, they, like any of us would, develop a sixth sense, a constant awareness about how what they do might affect their ability to raise money. They become, in the terms of the X-Files, shape-shifters, constantly adjusting their view, not about the first 10 top issues that they talk about in their campaigns, but about issue 111 to 1000. They become shapeshifters, adjusting their view in light of what they know will raise money. Leslie Byrne describes that when she first went to Congress, she's a Democrat from Virginia, she was told by a colleague, quote, always lean to the green. And then to clarify, she went on, he was not an environmentalist. Now, the point is, this is a dependence, too. But it is a different and conflicting dependence from the dependence intended by our framers, a dependence upon the people alone. Because, surprise, surprise, the funders are not the people. Indeed, as anybody who's been in this business recognizes, the people who get the attention of candidates are those who max out in their contributions to the candidates. So those who give what used to be $2,400, now $2,500. The percentage of America that maxes out is 0.05% of our population. 0.05% max out. So the Occupy Wall Street movement is missing a real opportunity here. It's not that we are the 99%. They are the 99.95%. The 99.95% who do not have systematic access to this government, and therefore we see the government distorting its decisions in a way that tracks this money. Now, I think it should be obvious to all of us, even though not yet to the Supreme Court, that this is corruption. Right? It's not brown paper bag corruption. Right? For most of the 20th century, members of Congress had safes in their office with lots of cash, and you might think, geez, I didn't know that they paid congressmen in cash. They didn't. They just had lots of cash in those safes. I don't know why. But that's not the kind of corruption I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about Rob Blagojevich kind of corruption. From that perspective, from that illegal quid pro quo perspective, ours is the cleanest Congress in the history of Congress. The corruption I'm talking about is a corruption of this intended dependence. It is, we could say, a dependence corruption, because it is the wrong dependence from the one intended, and that constitutes the corruption that we need to address. Now, if we're going to change this, we have to fix that dependence. If the problem is that the funders are not the people, the solution has got to be to make the funders the people. To give them a way That's actually two words. I don't mean to give Congress away. I know lots of people would like to do that. But to give Congress a way to fund without Faust, without selling their souls, and thereby without alienating America. And one way, maybe the only way, is to imagine establishing a system of publicly funded public elections. A system to substitute the large dollar funded campaigns that we have right now for small dollar funded campaigns, building on the examples of red state Arizona, red blue state Maine, blue state Connecticut, giving candidates a chance to opt into a system where they need to take small dollar contributions only because those contributions are appropriately amplified to make it possible for them to fund winning campaigns without ever taking large contributions from anyone. Now, there are lots of ways to do this, lots of different strategies for implementing the small dollar funded campaign. I describe one in my book, a little different from Arizona, Maine, and Connecticut. But the point I want you to think about, to recognize, the critical point about this way of funding campaigns is that if we had a system where the vast majority of candidates just took small dollar contributions, when Connecticut launched their system, 88% of candidates and incumbents opted into the system in the first year. So if we had something even close, 70% of candidates opting into the system, taking small dollar contributions only, then we could all believe, as we all want to believe, that when Congress did something stupid, it might have been because there are too many Democrats or too many Republicans, but the one reason that wouldn't race to the top of our list was because of the money. Because that alternative system would have removed the fundamental reason why we are so deeply cynical about what this Congress does. This is a way to change this system, to make it a system where the people are once again the core dependence that the Congress worries about. It's a way to restore the system and to give Congress a chance to at least be a little bit more trusted than King George III.
Lawrence Lessig, explaining why, without campaign finance reform, democracy is doomed. But, he says, we're going to have to get campaign finance reform despite the active opposition of Congress itself. Well, even if the solution doesn't seem near at hand, it's still helpful to grasp the scope of the problem itself. And Lessig sure helps us do that. Many thanks to Mike McCormick, who put Lessig's entire talk on his Seattle radio program, Mind Over Matters. You can find a link to that program on our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimae non carborundum, the lesser of two evils is still evil, and please come back and catch us again next week. Ciao.